Welcome to episode 124 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abual-Samad from Navigant Research.
And I'm Rebecca Linland from Rebecca Drives.
And Dan is not with us this evening because he is helping his kids with their homework, with some math and book reports, and makes me actually feel pretty good about being old now that my kids are grown and out of the house, and I no longer have to deal with trying to help them with their algebra. Those were painful days.
So I help my 11-year-old niece sometimes with her homework because my sister, who is one of the most patient people on earth, just the two of them go at it. I've never seen anything like it. I'm like, what? They like become demons at each other.
Oh, it sounds just like when my kids are around. You know, it's like they wanted help, but as soon as I tried to give them help, then it's like they just would shut down and would not listen to anything I tried to tell them.
It's incredible. It's amazing. So I will step in, and it's actually been a lot of fun because like she was learning about qualitative and quantitative information in the science, in science. And I was able to really give her some very concrete examples of, you know, work that I do where we use qualitative and quantitative data and analysis and stuff. And it really stuck with her. So we have a lot of fun with it. But yes, I am. I do not envy Dan his task this evening.
Yeah. Well, and with that, why don't we move into what we've been driving?
Yes.
So what have you been driving?
So I've had the privilege of having a couple of cars for a number of weeks now for a variety of reasons. But last week I had the 2019 Cadillac XT4, that compact crossover that I'm really glad Cadillac did because it provides an entry into the brand for singles and smaller households. And I think the styling of it is really dramatic in a very good way. It's clean. It's got some cool headlamps. And I was happy every time I looked at it. I wasn't happy every time I drove it.
That's a little bit of a problem because, that's kind of the whole point.
I was disappointed, first of all, with the interior and the materials. And I feel like we say this every week when we talk about General Motors products, but the interior just is not up to snuff. I feel like the accountants just have the last word every time. And I just was so disappointed in the interior of the XT4. The materials, the touch, the fit, the finish. I mean, I was just really disappointed. This car, I think the base is 41.8, and the one that I had, which was the all-wheel drive premium luxury, goes for $48,685, so almost $49,000. And I want to feel like I'm driving a Cadillac, like that brand, that name, as we've talked about before, in the past, that brand is so iconic. And I just don't feel like this vehicle reminds the driver that they're in a Cadillac. The other issue that I had with this, and Sam, I don't think you had the same issue. I brought it up last week too, was the steering and the feel of it was so loose that I actually felt out of control sometimes. And I think I kept trying to pinpoint it. I think part of it is that I'm used to speed adjusted steering. So, the faster you go, the tighter the steering becomes. And maybe this has it, but it's so extreme that like as I'm backing out at low speed, the steering wheel just felt so loose and just not in that. Again, that tight, sort of responsive feel that almost, I always prefer a little bit heavier steering anyway. But this was so light that it wasn't enjoyable. It wasn't, I didn't have confidence when I was driving it.
So was it like just a feeling of being overboosted, or like, did it feel like it was disconnected and not, you know, when you turn the wheel, the wheels weren't turning?
It was very disconnected. It was very disconnected.
I mean, that sounds more like it's a mechanical problem with that particular vehicle, because really? Yeah, I did the launch drive last year and then drove one for a week earlier this year and did not have that issue. And I think Dan drove one and I don't think he had that issue either. And I haven't heard of anybody else having a similar issue with the steering on the XT4.
I prefer a weightier feel. So it could just be me. It really could just be me. I prefer a weightier feel to my steering, and I couldn't get it from this. I just didn't have that feeling to it. And the whole car sort of, I do remember we had one out at Heels and Wheels back in June, and three of us drove it and none of us were thrilled with it. None of us real. And we were all the target audience. You know, it was all women as we were Heels and Wheels and, you know, all in our 40s, early 50s, you know, kids out of the house or no kids, one kid. And none of us were really impressed with the vehicle. And we all wanted to be. We were all kind of rooting for this vehicle and just didn't love it. But I was just not comfortable driving it.
Yeah, it sounds like there's definitely something wrong with that one. You know, when I drove it, the steering felt fine. I thought generally the driving dynamics were pretty good. But I agree with you that the interior is definitely underwhelming. And actually, the base price is only, it's $35,600 or $35,700.
Okay. So I don't know why I have 41 here. Okay.
I think that might be the base price for the premium lux trim level. There's the luxury and then the premium lux and the sport. And so that might be the base price for the premium lux.
Right.
Base price is like just under 36, for the 2020. They raised the price by about $700 from 2019 models.
Oh, wow.
Overall, I agree with what you said. I'm curious about your thoughts on the NVH, you know, the noise levels this car.
Again, I didn't have all I could think of was I wish it had the Buick quiet tuning because my little Coco, my little Enclave or Encore rather, is quiet. Like I like that. I wanted that luxury feel to it and I just didn't have it. I could have been driving anything.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the biggest issue I had with the XT4 overall was how much noise was coming through, both from the engine and also road noise when you're on, especially when you're on certain asphalt surfaces that are more textured.
Sure.
There was a lot of road noise being transmitted through into the cabin. And, you know, for a Cadillac, you know, or for any premium vehicle, you expect that to be much more muted. And,
exactly.
You know, it felt like something, you know, that you might pay, you know, $15,000-$17,000 for, not $40,000.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, I feel like a luxury brand, a luxury branded product should always remind you that you have paid a premium for this, that, you know, that this is why you pay a premium for things. And I just was really disappointed because there's so many things I like about it. You know, the exterior is beautiful. I love this size for the brand. Like I want this car to do well. And I think it looks great on the road.
Yeah, it's got a great stance to it, you know, and really nice proportions.
Yes.
And you know, from the outside, it does look like a premium vehicle. It
It does.
And one of the things I really liked about it, you know, is, you know, the long greenhouse, you know, the side glass extends way back.
Yes.
So that when you're sitting in the back seat, you're not sitting in between the rear pillars. You actually, when you look over to the side, you actually have glass on the side and you can see out. So you don't have that confined feeling in there like you do in so many other utilities.
Yes.
And this one, you know, definitely, you know, does well in that respect.
Yes. Nice big sunroof. You know, again, there's things that were really terrific about it from a looks and appearance standpoint. But, you know, I love the dual exhaust, kind of the big beefy feel to it. You know, I'm just looking at pictures now of like the back and it just looks great. And I just, you know, I was really excited to have it for the week. And, you know, hoping that my brief experience with it back at Heels and Wheels in June would kind of, you know, we would be, I could get a better feeling to it. And man, I just, you know, it was just really underwhelming and pretty disappointing. So
yeah, that's too bad because I agree with you. I think, you know, Cadillac needed a vehicle like this in its lineup. And
yes.
it's a shame that they didn't really, it seems like they didn't really fully commit to doing it right. You know, they got partway there and then stopped.
Exactly. They did. And, you know, I feel like there's just small things. I wanted little chrome touches where there should be touches. And when you think about other vehicles that we've talked about recently, and again, I feel like we keep going back to like the Hyundai Palisade and the Kia Telluride, because they're just fantastic. Those interiors are beautiful. And, you know, when I think back on like the Mercedes GLC interior, you know, or an Audi Q3 or Q5, you know, vehicles that compete directly with the XT4, this interior just doesn't cut it. It's just not enough to move people into this vehicle when there's so much competition in this compact luxury space and really, really good competition.
Speaking of which, we'll be talking about, I had a chance to drive the Lincoln Corsair last week.
Yes.
And we'll be talking about that later. Yeah.
Well, I'd love to talk about it now because I think it's a direct competitor and I think it's, okay. You know, so tell us all about it.
So, yeah, you're right. The Corsair is very much a direct competitor to the XT4. Although, you know, interestingly, or I guess not really surprisingly, you know, the folks from Lincoln did not really talk about the XT4 at all, you know, in their discussions. You know,
that's awesome.
they were targeting, you know, the Germans, you know, the Q3 and the X3 and the Acura RDX, you know, as their, those are the ones they benchmark,
you know, for this thing. Wise though? I mean, do you think?
I think, yeah, because, you know, it was very clear that what they were not trying to do was be just like them. You know, they consider them
just like Cadillac.
No.
Oh, the Germans,
like the Germans and Acura.
Okay.
You know, what they wanted to be seen as is, you know, on a par with them, but in their own distinct way. So they are not trying, you know, and in the review I wrote up, you know, I talked about, you know, Cadillac, you know, over the last 15 years, you know, really tried to copy the Germans in a lot of ways. You know, they wanted to be seen as just like BMW and just like Mercedes and Audi.
Yes.
And they never quite got there, even though they made some really good vehicles. And what Lincoln has done is something, you know, they have created a distinctly American flavor. You know, their own
American luxury, right?
Yeah, their own unique take on luxury that is very premium. It's, you know, when you look at it, when you sit in it, it's not really anything at all like a BMW or a Mercedes or an Audi or an Acura, but it is something that feels like it might be worth that same kind of price point as those competitive vehicles. And that's where the Cadillac falls short.
The Aviator interior is a good example. Yeah. And I'm so disappointed I wasn't able to go on the Corsair launch because it would have been fantastic. But I mean, if it's anything like the Aviator interior, you know, it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, and it's very much like that. You know, it has a lot of that same kind of flavor. You know, obviously it's at a lower price point than the Aviator, but, you know, and it's all, you know, they've scaled it down, you know, size wise. You know, it's like a, in a lot of ways, it's like a 3/4 scale Aviator, but, you know, because it's a 2-row, it's a compact, and, you know, sure. it shares its basic platform with the Escape, but, you know, this new flexible architecture that Ford has developed gives them a lot more freedom to move things around and change things. So, you know, it's the same wheelbase as the Escape, but it's a little bit wider and it's not quite as tall. So it's got, you know, a little bit sleeker look to it. And like the Aviator, you know, when you look at it in profile, the roof line kind of slopes down a little bit towards the back, you know, and, you know, Lincoln's theme is this idea of quiet flight. You know, and so, you know, they tried to craft it into something that looks like it's moving through the air. And, you know, I think they were successful with it. You know, it's got nice sculpted sides, you know, that capture the light really well. And, you know, the interior is so much better than the XT4. I mean, it's night and day difference. There's just no comparison.
Well, you know, and the price point is almost exactly the same. The starting price.
Yeah, they're within a couple hundred dollars starting price. You know, as you march up, you know, and add equipment, there's more stuff that's available on the Lincoln that's not available on the Cadillac. Like the Cadillac only has the single engine option, the 2-liter, which is fine. But, you know, in the Lincoln, you have an option for a 2.3-liter. There's other equipment that's available that you can't get on the Cadillac right now. You know, they have their Copilot 360 Plus, you know, with their lane centering capability, which is not quite as sophisticated as Cadillac Super Cruise, but you can't get Super Cruise on an XT4. You can get Copilot on the Lincoln.
So I don't think that my XT4 had adaptive cruise control.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Which I was shocked about.
Yeah.
I was shocked. And I mean, I don't use it a lot, but I just was.
It doesn't come standard on the Lincoln either. You know, you get the Copilot 360, the base Copilot 360 package, which is lane centering or lane keeping assist, blind spot monitoring, the forward collision alert and automatic emergency braking, you know, auto high beams. You know, all that comes standard, and you know, all of that is an extra cost option on the Cadillac. So you get that much standard, and then you know, there's an optional package that adds the radar sensor, upgrades it to lane centering instead of lane keeping assist, and gives you adaptive cruise control, and you know, all the way up the equipment, you know, the price walk for the Cadillac, you know, a comparably equipped Corsair is similar, but then you can go above and beyond what's there. But even at the same price point, you know, the interior of the Lincoln is so much nicer. It's a much nicer place to be. And, sure. You know, they did a lot of work on the noise control in there. So, you know, and the Corsair, you've got acoustic side glass on the front doors, and, you know, laminated windshield. There's the double wall fire bulkhead like you have in the Aviator and in the Explorer, which the Escape does not have. So what that does is the bulkhead it's a double wall bulkhead, and it creates an air gap in there so that there's less transmission of noise from the engine compartment.
Nice.
And then there's also a full underbody shield. So the whole thing is a much quieter experience, you know, much like the Aviator was, and it's a much more serene experience when you're driving, and you know, it's just a really nice place to be. And we drove from the reserve model that we drove, you know, the 2.3-liter all wheel drive reserve came to just over $60,000, which is a little bit higher than you know, the top end. The XT4, if you do all the options on there, you can get it up to about 58. And so this is a little bit higher, but you know, that 58 for the Cadillac, that's only a 2-liter engine. It's a less powerful engine, you know, and it's not as nice an interior, you know, for the, you know, in the $60,000 Lincoln, you have the 24-way adjustable seats, you know, that have adjustable thigh supports that are, you know, individually adjustable for each leg. It's got massage seats. And this is one of the odd things when I drove the XT4 last time. It has a massaging seat option, but all it does is, you know, the lumbar support bladders, you know, inflate. There's three bladders in there that you can inflate. And all it does is inflate them and deflate them in sequence. So it just kind of rolls along your back. And,
okay.
And the thing is, each time the bladders deflate, you can hear the a little whoosh out of the back of your seat as the air rushes out. And then you hear it hear them getting pumped up again. And then the whoosh. And whereas in the Lincoln seats, you know, it was totally quiet. And you don't hear any of that.
Yeah. So that's not okay.
Yeah. You know, and then, you know, compared to the Escape, you know, which shares a lot of its basic underpinnings with this thing, you know, it's a little bit wider. So you have a little bit more hip and shoulder room, not a lot, but, you know, just enough that it's noticeable. And, you know, one of the things I really liked that was different from the Escape, you know, the Escape, the side mirrors are mounted at the base of the A-pillars. And so you still have a fairly prominent blind spot there, you know, when you look at the base of the A-pillars, even though the A-pillars on both, you know, on the new ones are significantly slimmer than on the previous generation, you still have that blind spot at the base of the A-pillars. And on the Corsair, the mirrors are actually mounted on the doors. And then there's a little quarter window down right at the base of the A-pillar there.
Yep.
So you have, you know, noticeably better visibility to the front corners there, which is always a good thing. And, you know, it's funny, you know, I was just in San Francisco 3 weeks ago driving the Lincoln Navigator, you know, and, you know, driving that thing around San Francisco and then driving this thing around San Francisco. It was so utterly different. This, you know, if you live in a city, you know, or commute in a city, a vehicle like this is such a much better choice to have. You know, it's so much easier to maneuver, you know, to park.
Absolutely.
You know, and you have features in this like, you know, like active park assist, you know, next generation active park assist that all you have to do is hold down the button on the console and you don't have to do any steering. You don't have to shift back and forth between drive and reverse. You don't have to touch the brakes. It does that all automatically as it's backing you into either parallel or perpendicular parking space. What else? Oh, and then upcoming, there's also going to be a plug-in hybrid version of this as well, which should be launching probably sometime late winter, early spring.
Like, you know, the Escape has.
Like the Escape has. But my guess is, you know, we don't know yet because we haven't seen details on it yet. But my guess is that Lincoln is going to follow a similar pattern to what they did with the Aviator Grand Touring, which is make it more of a performance upgrade. So, you know, instead of, you know, whereas the Escape has a 2.5 liter naturally aspirated engine with their hybrid, you know, it does about 190 horsepower. My guess is that we're going to see one of the turbocharged engines paired with the plug-in hybrid system and possibly even an electric motor on the rear axle. The Escape plug-in hybrid is going to be front wheel drive only because the battery spans across under the front seats, and so you can't run the drive shaft through. But I'm guessing that the Aviator, I wouldn't be surprised if the Aviator had all wheel drive with an electric motor at the rear axle to supplement the front, you know, which will get you somewhere probably between 350 and 400 horsepower total, you know, whereas the 2.3 liter or the 2.3 currently does 295, which is really good.
Right.
But, you know, to have that extra power, you know, again, that would make it even more competitive with some of the premium European marks.
Right. Well, it sounds amazing. I can't wait to drive it. I don't know when I'll get the opportunity, but hopefully soon, because I mean, I think just Lincoln is absolutely killing it right now. And the way that they've rolled out their name changes and the products they're rolling out, they're just gorgeous. I don't know if they're to continue with Matthew McConaughey, because I don't know. Did they address that at all?
We didn't talk about that, but I mean, they just put out another commercial for the Aviator Grand Touring with McConaughey in it.
Yes.
So we'll see. Okay. It doesn't seem to be hurting him at this point. So, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, it's fun to watch.
Yeah. There was one complaint dynamically that I had. There were two complaints we had with the Corsair.
Okay.
One was the almost complete absence of steering feedback, just like in the Escape.
The weighting
of the steering was fine, you know, and especially if you put it in an Excite mode, you know, it had good effort, but you don't really feel what's going on at the front wheels, you know, as you're cornering. So there's no feedback there, which most people that are going to buy this probably won't care anyway. But, you know, for an enthusiast, you know, you want to have a little bit more information, you know, tactile information about what's going on. It wasn't the kind of disconnected feeling that you're describing in your Cadillac. But so that was one issue. And then the other one had to do with one of the things that Lincoln has changed this year. And I think the Aviator actually had this too, although I didn't notice this happening on the Aviator. The button for the voice control. In the past, Ford and Lincoln have had that in a series of buttons in one of the lower quadrants of the steering wheel. And on the new ones, that there's a button, the button for the voice control is now on the upper left-hand side. So when you're holding the steering wheel at the 9 and 3, the button is just above your left thumb. And, you know, so you can, you don't even have to move your hands at all. You can just, you know, reach your thumb up, tap that button to issue a voice command to the Sync 3 system, which
that
is fine.
That sounds really a good placement. I like
it,
that.
It is, until you start driving on some twisty mountain roads and your hands are moving around on the steering wheel. And I was driving with John Volker, formerly the editor of Green Car Reports, and both of us repeatedly were triggering the voice control as we were driving through, you know, driving down Skyline Boulevard and some of the other mountain roads, you know, along the Northern California coast. And, you know, so every time we, you know, as we moved our hands on the wheel, hit that, inadvertently trigger that button, and then the voice command thing would come up on the center screen, and you'd have to, you know, somebody'd have to hit cancel on there. So that was a minor annoyance. And again, most people driving this thing are probably never going to experience that.
Right. But it reminds me of the Alfa Romeo Stelvio, where on the Quadrifoglio where the push button start is, it's on the steering wheel. And so if you end up parking it at an angle or something, then it's really awkward to start it.
Yes. Yeah. The starter button is on the just below the left hand steering wheel spoke.
Yeah. You sort of have to locate it when you first turn the car, you know, trying to get the car to turn on.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, again, as I said, it's a minor annoyance. I think most people would learn to live with it, but it is a little quirk of this car.
Right.
But aside from that, you know, the rest of it was all really nice materials. We drove a 2.3 and a 2.0 liter, both of which had this aluminum trim strip across the dashboard. They call it a pinstripe aluminum because it actually had some pinstripes carved into it. It looks really, you know, really classy. It's a nice little touch. And you know, overall it's a really nice looking vehicle.
That's excellent. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, speaking of hybrids and plug-in hybrids, I also had the Toyota RAV4 hybrid, which is really competes almost directly with the Ford Escape.
Yeah, it's in the same segment as the Escape.
Yes. So have you driven that yet?
I have not had the hybrid. I had a RAV4 briefly earlier this summer, and I think I talked about it. You know, I had an issue with Android Auto. When I plugged in my phone, it kept rebooting the infotainment system. And so they took it back to check it out, and I haven't been able to schedule back into a RAV4 again yet. Turns out there was some kind of conflict between my particular phone, a Google Pixel 3, and the infotainment system, because other Android phones that they tried worked just fine. I don't know if they've corrected that problem yet, but I haven't had a chance to get back into a RAV4 since then.
So I did not have any such problems when I connected. It wanted me to download the Entune system thing, which I didn't. I didn't do yet. Maybe I will tomorrow, but I've mostly, just because it doesn't support Android Auto, I really haven't played around with it, the telematics very much because it's just annoying. As I said, even today when I plugged it in, it wanted me to download something else. But what I did find is that the hybrid is so loud. Like when I'm backing up, it makes this awful high-pitched whining sound. And again, I feel like I have these weird things, or maybe I just notice things differently than you and Dan and other people. But it just, it's, as soon as I put it into reverse, and it's just, it's like, huh. You know, it's the, I mean, obviously it's not an engine. It's not the engine noise. Again, it's these, the hybrid part of it, I find to be quite distracting. And doesn't really enhance my driving. Now, I will say that if you're in stop and go traffic and you put the adaptive cruise control on and such, I think it's a fine choice if you have a bearish commute like you probably would in California, you know, and gas being high and such. But I find that it's just noisy. The whole thing is noisy. I love, again, I feel like I'm talking about the XT4 again. I love the exterior. I think the styling is super sharp. This one has the blacked out package, so it doesn't have any chrome on it. Black rims. It's this beautiful dark blueprint blue metallic. It's just gorgeous. And, you know, again, it looks fantastic, and the size, it's so much bigger that some of my family first thought that it was the Highlander. I'm like, no, this is the RAV4. It's just much bigger. And my brother has an old Escape, and we were kind of laughing. We're like, wow, it's like this, it's almost, I'm sorry, he has an old Explorer. And we were laughing, thinking like, it's like practically the size of your Explorer, because his Explorer is like over 10 years old. And it's just, you know, again, it looks great. It's, you know, there's a lot of really good features in it. The adaptive cruise control works really, really well. And, you know, I think it's cool. I was sort of trying to hypermile a little bit by putting, you know, trying to use as much of the hybrid power as possible. And it's tough on some of the hills around where I live, but you know, it's a RAV4. It's a good, reliable vehicle. The interior is terrific, but I just find the hybrid part of it to be loud. It's got the 2.5 liter four cylinder. It's the CVT is very CVT-ish.
Yeah. Well, that's typical so, Toyota.
It is. It's very typical Toyota. And even, you know, I've been leaving it mostly in normal drive. I did put it in sport for a while to see if that kind of made it a little bit more engaging, but you know, it's a Toyota with a CVT engine. It's not designed for performance. The looks of it are great, but you know, again, I think if you've got a commute that, you know, the hybrid would help you with the fuel economy, then go for it. I'm actually not getting that great fuel economy though. I'm right around 38, which is what it, you know, the city's 41, highway's 38. I guess I've been kind of mostly on highway, but I just don't think it's all that great for you know, what you're giving up a lot of comfort and quiet with the hybrid. And this one's 38,000 delivered, 38,294. It starts at 33.7. And then that Entune premium audio is 1620. That includes navigation, which has actually worked out pretty well. Like the interacting with the telematics has actually been very good. It's very ergonomically friendly. It has a nice charging pad right in the, you know, right where you would want it to be in the center console, and it has a nice big cubby hole. So again, it's very easy to live with. I like the fact that the second row seats tilt back and forth, and you can get those really comfortable, and it's very easy to get a fold flat floor as well. So we've been going back and forth, cleaning out my mom's house and able to transport a lot of stuff in this guy. And so it's, you know, I think it's a great vehicle for for utility, for functionality and such. I'm not all that sold on the hybrid part of it.
Well, you said you got 38?
Yes.
So the EPA rating is for combined is 39. It's 41 city, 37 highway.
So you're
getting right on what it's rated at.
Which is
pretty good. I mean, you know, for an SUV that size, you know, to get 38 miles per gallon, you know, I think that's reasonably impressive.
It is. No, yeah. It is. It is for sure. I mean, Coco probably gets about 27, 28. I can get up to 30 if I'm on the highway and not going really fast, which doesn't happen a lot. But but no, it's but, you know, it's good. Again, I think that there is a very definitive place for this type of vehicle in the marketplace and in somebody's driveway.
And to your comments on the size, you know, it's actually not that far off the size of what the first generation Highlander was. You know, it's grown a lot.
That's really funny.
So, I just as you were talking, I pulled up the specs on KBB for various years. So the first generation RAV4 four door, 2000 model year, was the first generation one. It was 163.8 inches long. The first generation Highlander, looking at a 2005 model, was 184.6 inches long.
Oh, wow. That's a big difference.
The current RAV4 that just came out is 180.9 inches long. So it's almost as long as the original Highlander was. And it's actually an inch wider than the first generation Highlander was.
Wow. So what is Highlander now?
It's quite a bit larger than that. Give me a second here and I'll find it.
It's gotta be over 200 then, I think.
Yeah. Well, and there's a new one, you know, the 2020 model is coming out later this year, which I think is even going to be slightly larger than that. Let's see. So 2017, I don't have the specs on the 2020 yet. So the 2019 Highlander is 192.5 inches long. So it's about a foot longer than the RAV4 and about 8 inches longer than the first generation Highlander was. And it's almost 76 inches wide. So it's 3 inches wider than the current RAV4.
Wow.
So
big.
It has gotten a lot larger, just as, you know, as pretty much all new vehicles have, you know, or each. Yes. Each generation of a particular nameplate tends to get bigger and heavier than the one before. Mostly heavier. And recently, they've started to actually get lighter. Even though they're getting bigger, they have actually started to get lighter over the last few years. Like the new Escape.
To steal, right.
The new Escape is 200 pounds lighter.
I mean, that's incredible, really. What an achievement.
The Corsair is about 100 pounds lighter than the MKC was, even though it's about an inch and a half longer than it was before and has a lot more equipment in it.
I was going to say, right. It has a lot more equipment, a lot more safety features. Yeah, no, the progression of vehicle size is just fascinating. And so I think, you know, the RAV4, I think I'm thrilled that there's a hybrid to it. I think that it will sell really, really well for them. This one had all-wheel drive, which, again, getting 38 with all-wheel drive.
That's actually the only way you can get the RAV4 really hybrid is all-wheel drive.
Oh, is with all-wheel drive? Okay, yeah, well, that's good. I like that.
And it's an electric all-wheel drive, too. So there's an electric motor on the rear axle, which I think the approach that we're probably going to see from Lincoln for the plug-in hybrid Escape or Corsair, I mean.
So what do you think that sound is that I'm hearing then?
Did you say it's a whining sound?
It's a whining sound in reverse. And you know, maybe I'll try and record it tomorrow.
Yeah, I know at various times on some of their hybrids, Toyota has done electric drive for reverse. So when you put it in reverse, it just uses the electric drive to back it up rather than turning on the engine.
It's for sure that.
Yeah. And so it may be that the gear set that, you know, so if it's using the rear axle to drive it in reverse, which may be the case, you know, the gears, when you're running them backwards, it may be It may be that may be what's making the noise.
It's for sure that noise, because it happens every single time, and there's never an instance that it hasn't happened.
Yeah,
and it's annoying. I mean, you know, sort of like that bladder noise that you mentioned.
Right. That's kind of odd, because Toyota hybrids are usually very quiet. And in fact, I have a Lexus hybrid in the driveway right now that we'll talk about next week. But and it's very, very quiet. So
maybe I'm just being picky and cranky. I don't know.
That could be. you haven't been on enough trips lately in the last couple of weeks. So
exactly.
you've been home for too many days in a row. So maybe that's the problem.
Maybe that is the problem. But
first
again,
world problems.
You know, I think I would easily recommend the product, you know, especially to people that have, a bad commute, because it's great. You're getting great fuel economy. You're in a really nice vehicle. It's a nice size. It has heated seats. I love the ventilated seats, I have to say. But overall, I think it's a great vehicle. It does what it's supposed to do, and it does it really well. And again, the interior is really cool. They have this, this bright blue line that runs through. It's a, like top stitching, and it just adds a nice feature to it. You know, it's things that they didn't have to do, but make it better because it's there. And again, the livability of this vehicle is very, very good. I will say I feel sometimes like I'm going to hit my head on the A-pillar just because the way that I have the seat positioned. And that's not always the case. So I wouldn't mind it being a little bit less rakishly sloped. But of course, that's what gives it good looks too. But overall, I think the livability of this vehicle is really high, and people would enjoy it.
Well, that's great. So, yeah. I only had a very brief time in the RAV, and I'm looking forward to actually trying it again. But it was, I like the way it looks. You know, I think it's definitely the best looking RAV4 yet.
Yes, for sure.
I was never terribly fond of most of the earlier iterations of it, but this one's definitely good.
And I feel like it's really high tech. Again, it's kind of, It rewards you for buying the hybrid. You know what I mean? Like, it rewards you for, it gives you that nice high-tech feel. It has automatic headlamps that are, by the way, incredibly bright, like fantastically so, which I really enjoy. And, the backup camera and the guidelines and things like that, that are just, they're really premium. This has a nice premium feel to it. Overall, which, again, when you think about the Cadillac, what Cadillac stands for, it doesn't have that same feel. And so if I'm comparing, and you wouldn't ordinarily compare these two vehicles, but because I had them back to back, they're very similar in size. I really enjoyed being in the RAV4. I didn't love driving it. I don't love the hybrid engine in certain cases, particularly going uphill. Again, I sort of feel like it's a little, definitely is very dependent upon the engine. But overall, it's just, it's a Toyota. It's a good vehicle.
Yeah. And you generally can't go too far wrong with the Toyota.
Exactly.
So briefly, I had one other car before heading out to California to drive the Corsair, and that was the Honda Civic Type R. Which I've driven before.
So fun. Yes.
And have you driven the Type R?
I have. I loved it.
It is a fantastic car to drive.
So
it's
fun.
It's I'm not, I have complained about the way it looks, particularly that wing on the back, and I actually recently saw one on the road here, a Type R, that the owner had taken the wing off. So you just, look, and it was black.
Oh.
So it looked more like a standard Civic hatchback, which isn't too bad.
Cool.
The thing is, if you can get past the way it looks on the outside, I'll admit it looks juvenile, but who cares? You get in the thing. Okay. It looks a little juvenile on the inside too, with the red and black seats and the red trim everywhere, but fine. Ignore all that. Just get in, press the clutch pedal down, hit the start button. And, when you look out the rear window, the wing is contoured, And it's up high enough so it's actually above the top of the rear glass. So you don't even see the wing from inside the car. Right, so you have no idea that it's there once you're inside.
Exactly.
So just close your eyes, get in the car and drive. Get in the car, open your eyes first, then drive, and you will have a ball with this thing. You
know, it is a blast.
You know, and Honda did an amazing job on the suspension on this thing, especially the front suspension. It's got this dual axis strut set up so that it separates the different loads for steering and acceleration to the front wheels. So it virtually eliminates torque steer. You'll almost never really feel any torque steer in this thing. And, you know, if you're driving into curves, you know, if you're driving on a track, it's amazing. But even on the street, you know, diving into a curve, you know, you can trail the brakes into the curve and, you know, have the back end come around just a little bit. It's really easy to control, so you can place it exactly where you want on the road, you know, so you can get, you know, you don't have, it's not going to understeer on you. And it's actually, you know, so 307 horsepower from the 2-liter turbocharged engine. It seems, you know, like this should be a really hardcore car, but it's actually surprisingly easy to live with, you know, even on, you know, like the 30 or 35 series tires that were on this thing. The ride quality is actually amazingly good. Granted, I don't think you'd want to hit any Michigan potholes with it just because the sidewalls are so skinny. You're probably going to bend a wheel if you do that. But, you know, in terms of like frost heaves and things like that, you know, it's actually a surprisingly supple suspension. It does a really good job of soaking everything up, so it doesn't punish you. You know, it's really easy to drive as a daily driver, and it's so much fun because it just goes.
It does. It does everything you want it to do. I just remember thinking that it was, you know how there's some cars that you kind of look at and you're like, oh, you're still here.
Yeah.
And this one was just, it just was joyful. It's just joy. I mean, it's so much fun. I thought the manual transmission was incredibly good. So precise. And as you said, the steering was just impeccable. But it was much more livable than expected. And there's nothing else really like it on the road because it's sort of like they've funked it up, you know, from the factory, though, like from the showroom. So everything works on it. I mean, it looks great. It really brings it back to Honda roots, you know, in my mind. I love it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's exactly the kind of car you want from a performance Honda. And it's just a ball to drive. And, you know, the red trim and the red Honda badges, you know, will remind you what it is you're driving. You'll never forget what you got, which, you know, nothing wrong with that.
No, I like that. I think they were a really good steward of the brand with this product and of the performance of their heritage. It celebrates driving, really. It celebrates old school manual transmission car driving. And that's loads of fun.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. So, did you have to give it back already?
Yeah, unfortunately, I dropped it off at the airport when I went off on the Corsair trip. But I had it for a whole week it's a hoot to drive. And the one I had was in this, gray color. I forget what exactly it was called.
Like almost China gray. They call it something.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a nice color. The one complaint that I think some people might have about it besides its looks, it also has these massive Brembo brakes on it and, they're steel calipers or steel, rotors and, pretty high performance brake pads on there. And they do squeal a bit make some grinding sounds, but you know, if you want good brakes, that's one of the things you have to pay. That's one of the prices you have to pay.
Right. Yeah. And if you complain about that, you don't understand it.
Exactly. In that case, you shouldn't be driving a Type R.
Exactly. Oh, that's awesome. Glad you got that. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool.
Acura is launching a new ad campaign. So why don't you tell us about that?
So they have a new ad campaign that is interesting. It's the tagline is Less Talk, More Drive, which I like the tagline. I think that's clever. They're focusing on their heritage and they're focusing on their car heritage in particular. So I think tonight is when they're going to start showing some of the ads. They mentioned the NFL. I don't know if they're showing it tonight on Monday Night Football or not, but it basically is focusing on what they call their memorable sports cars for the road and the track, similar, you know, no doubt to the origins of the Honda Civic, but looking at things like the Integra Type R and the first generation NSX and such. What makes this so interesting to me is that they're focusing on cars. They're not looking at their crossovers at all, which is fine, except that crossovers are 70% of the market. And so.
And at least 70% of Acura's volume.
Right. I mean, it's really narrowing in, you know, and so you're talking to a very small percentage of the new car buyer segment because premium is running about 30% of new cars, 30 to 35%. And Acura plays in that premium space. And then you're focusing on their cars. And so again, you've now doubled down on that 30%, where now you're only talking to 30% of your new car buyers. And I think, I don't know exactly what the split is on luxury, but I think it's pretty close to that. I think it's still following the market in terms of 70% SUVs now for luxury. I'll look that up to confirm that. But you know, I think it'll be interesting to watch and see how this develops. They are targeting a younger consumer, particularly with the digital media, which I think is actually a pretty good idea because anecdotally, when I talk to some people that are, say, under 35, a lot of them actually haven't really driven that many sedans. They grew up in minivans and SUVs. And so they really enjoy driving a sedan. It's fun, you know, it's in a sports car and it gives you much more of that driving experience that Acura is trying to focus in on. And of course, the less talk, more drive also, you know, implies put down your phone and drive. And so, you know, it's a little bit more subtle, clever way of saying, you know, don't text and drive and don't be on your phone, but just drive instead. So it's kind of a dual message there. But, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how this does with them. And they're rolling out a little bit what they call edgier styling and better performance. I don't know how you get much more edgier than some of what Acura has done in the recent past. I actually like some of their more toned down versions of vehicles lately. So I'll be anxiously watching to see what they come out with.
Well, I think the Type S concept that they showed at Pebble Beach is, you know, I think that's a clue as to where they're going with their design. Yeah, and it's a continuation of this, you know, precision design concept that they brought out a couple of years ago, and that they have rolled out to things like vehicles like the RDX and the refresh on the ILX and some of the other models. And, you know, I think that Type S that we saw is probably a preview of the next generation TLX, which is, you know, probably going to be coming next spring. I think we'll probably see it at the New York Auto Show, most likely next spring. And, you know, my guess is that, you know, if this campaign, this theme continues for Acura, that we're probably going to see some additional ads or maybe, you know, in some of the other mediums, you know, besides just this TV commercial, that start to feature, you know, some of the crossovers as well, you know, and get in, you know, vehicles like the RDX A-Spec. And, you know, we're probably, I would guess, you know, sometime in the next year, we'll probably see next generation MDX as well. And, you know, perhaps there will be a performance oriented version of that, just like, you know, they have the MDX Sport Hybrid now, you know, and so a next generation version of that could start to fit into this. So Because a lot of what you see in this ad, you know, is the heritage vehicles. You know, there's not a lot of the current generation vehicles. You know, you've got the NSX and the TLX and ILX. And actually, there is an MDX in here, isn't there? Or is that an RDX?
Yeah, there is. Yeah. It's the MDX, isn't it?
Actually, it might be both of them. There's a crossover on each side, so it's probably both the MDX and the RDX, one on each side. So you know, even though you know the cars are front and center, the crossovers are still in there, and I think we're probably going to see more of that. You know, last year I talked to John Akeda, who's the head of Acura, and mm-hmm. you know he talked about you know where Acura is going, that you know they want to really get back to making it Honda's performance brand.
Right.
And so I think, you know, that regardless of which vehicles, you know, they're going to keep selling cars, but I think, you know, even on the utilities that comprise the bulk of their sales, that's where, you know, you're still going to see them moving towards a more of a performance orientation.
Well, and I think that's a fine idea. I mean, the NSX is still just a stunningly fabulous vehicle. And so, you know, they have the chops for it. I think it's an interesting angle of approach, you know, towards this. And I'll be anxious to see how it unfolds. But to your earlier point, they will be running network TV, cable, and streaming video. And so they're going to be putting this. We'll be seeing a lot of this out. And they're also doing what they call high profile NFL games. So I assume that's all my New England Patriots games. We'll see what happens there.
Last week, Hyundai made an interesting announcement with Aptiv. And for those that don't know, Aptiv is a major tier one automotive supplier that a couple of years, the Aptiv name is relatively new. It's only been around a couple of years. It was previously Delphi. And Delphi used to be GM's parts division before they got spun out by GM in the late 90s. They went through a long 5-year long bankruptcy reorganization in the mid 2000s. And then, you know, they came out, you know, in the early part of this decade, you know, as a much more slimmed down company. And then a couple of years ago, they split the company in two. The powertrain systems division became Delphi Technologies. And you know, they do fuel injection systems and electric motors and all kinds of other stuff. And then the electrical architecture and autonomous driving division became Aptiv. So now Aptiv is pairing up with Hyundai, and their autonomous driving group is going into a new joint venture with Hyundai, which seems to be a real, you know, vote of confidence from Hyundai that they think that Aptiv is on the right track with their autonomous driving software and their systems. And so they valued this joint venture as 50-50 ownership between Aptiv and Hyundai. They valued it at $4 billion. Aptiv is putting in their AV team led by Carl and Yema, and Hyundai is putting in cash and also some engineering resources to develop a robo-taxi platform with Aptiv. And they're going to offer this up to anybody that wants to use it for robo-taxi applications. So, you know, they plan to launch this, you know, make this vehicle available starting in 2022. And, you know, I think that's, you know, it's interesting that, you know, Hyundai until a couple of years ago was talking about, you know, they probably wouldn't have autonomous vehicles until the late 20s, you know, maybe even, you know, closer to 2030. And now all of a sudden they are partnering up with Aptiv. And this is one of a string of partnerships we've seen in the autonomous vehicle space recently with companies, you know, pairing up. We had Volkswagen earlier this summer buying a stake in Argo AI, you know, which is also partly owned by Ford. And so they're working together. You know, we've had Honda hooking up with GM Cruise, and there's been a lot of other partnerships as well. So it's interesting that Hyundai and Aptiv are pairing off to do autonomous systems and robo taxis.
It is, and I actually think this is a really good pairing because it keeps Hyundai in its swim lane and it keeps Aptiv in its swim lane, but they're both in the same pool.
They're bringing very complementary stuff together because Aptiv doesn't build cars and they don't build,
right.
They build a lot of the stuff that goes into cars, but they don't build the cars. Hyundai is developing the vehicle platform and Aptiv is developing the autonomous driving system that's going to go on that vehicle platform.
And it gives them such a global, it gives Aptiv such a global presence because of course, you know, Hyundai is so huge globally that, you know, and doesn't just make cars and trucks, like they make a lot of other things. And so this could really be an incredible opportunity for Aptiv to spread its technology in many parts of the company. So it'll be really exciting to see what happens.
Yeah, I think it'll be good for both companies.
Yeah, for sure. But I also, you know, this, it reminds me just reading over things again, you know, as we said, like that idea of, you know, I think this timeline's a little unrealistic though. That's the only thing I will say is that they want to start testing their systems in 2020, which is, you know, that's 2020 is over in 15 months.
Aptiv has been testing, you know, developing their technology for several years now. And in fact, you know, they were actually the first ones to really launch a commercial robo-taxi service in Las Vegas last year at CES, 2018 at CES. Yeah. So, you know, like 11 months before Waymo, you know, soft launched their Waymo One service in Arizona, Aptiv did the same thing in Las Vegas with Lyft, in a partnership with Lyft.
Right.
And, you know, they have given, I think, over 75,000 paid rides now in Las Vegas with their fleet of vehicles. Now, granted, none of them, not Aptiv or Waymo or anybody else, are operating without safety drivers yet. But they are, you know, they have been operating these vehicles and giving rides to customers. You know, and Aptiv has also been part of a pilot program in Singapore since late 2016. Again, doing robo-taxi services in partnership with the Singapore Land Transit Authority, providing first mile, last mile services to connect residents of the city to mass transit services, you know, to take people to and from train stations.
So you don't think this timeline is unrealistic then, it sounds
well,
like.
not for testing, you know. So, you know, my guess is that, you know, what Hyundai will probably do is use their next generation they may be using their fuel cell platform from the Nexo, because that's actually what they've already been testing, because Hyundai's been working with Aurora, Chris Urmson's company, for the past year and a half. And they have vehicles, they have Hyundai Nexos that they've been testing in Korea with the Aurora platform on there. So my guess is that, you know, what we will probably see is Hyundai create more of a shuttle type of vehicle on their fuel cell platform, or perhaps on their next generation EV platform, and then apply Aptiv's technology on top of that.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, this, what I'm reading now, it says, if the venture receives approval from regulators, it should close in the second quarter of 2020. So, I mean, I assume that they are able to work together prior to that, but maybe not. It just seems, I guess I'm just looking at some of these timelines and thinking 2020 was always so far away and now it's not anymore. Yeah. You know, and there was a lot of stuff that was supposed to be done by 2020 that isn't done yet.
legally, I don't think that they're actually allowed to work together
until each one
can be working on their parts of it independently. So, right, you know, okay. Hyundai can be developing, you know, the vehicle platform, and Aptiv is in ongoing development on their AV platform. So, you know, then it's just a matter of integrating the two.
Sure. That makes sense. Well, and then speaking of some of these deals, the Amazon order of 100,000 Rivian vans.
Yeah.
I think this is fantastic.
So I'm curious why do you think it's such a great deal?
Because I think this is how we get electric vehicles into the mainstream through the commercial lane, as opposed to expecting consumers to take this on. And so suddenly you're going to start to see your Amazon products being delivered. And for background, this is Amazon and Rivian has, they've agreed on a six-figure order to buy 100,000 Rivians, electric vehicles, electric vans specifically. They're going to be custom built for Amazon Prime deliveries. And I think it's a really, really cool idea. And this is, Amazon had already made a $700 million investment in Rivian earlier in 2019, back in February. So I like the idea because it gives the viewing public the opportunity to see electric vehicles on the road without having to make the commitment. And it brings a more familiarity to them. They can talk to their driver, you know, the delivery guy. Hey, what do you think of that? It's electric. What are you having range issues? How do you charge that thing? It allows them to sort of the neighborhood effect that we talk about with when we think about electric vehicles. And it brings it into your neighborhood, and it brings it into a space that is familiar to you. And but that is risk-free for you, relatively speaking, unless, you know, unless you're, the package is dependent, it doesn't get there for some reason, but you know, you don't have to, you're not making that investment, but you're still learning about the technology. And so that's why I really like this deal. I think it's a way to demystify the electric vehicle through the commercial space.
No, I agree with you. I think, you know, commercial applications are actually, economically, they make a lot more sense for EVs right now than individual consumer sales, because, you know, the average person drives about 12 to 15,000 miles a year. In many cases, a lot less than that. And to, you know, the cost premium for an EV and the potential fuel savings, you know, over the course of a year relative to a fairly efficient gas powered car, make it very difficult to justify the cost of an EV for an average consumer. You know, the example I've been giving people a lot lately is the Kia Niro. You know, the base Kia Niro is a 50 mile per gallon hybrid that costs $23,000. The Kia Niro EV, great EV, goes 239 miles on a charge, but it costs $39,000. And so even after the tax breaks, you're still looking at about an $8,000 to $8,500 cost premium to get the EV. And when you compare it to that 50 mile per gallon hybrid, the payback time in fuel savings is going to be about 30 years for the average consumer, which is, wow. That's, yeah, you know, and you know, depending on what you're, you know, what vehicles you're making the comparison to, like, you know, if you were comparing it to say a 35 mile per gallon, you know, compact car, you know, then that shortens, but it's still going to be, you know, in the 15 to 20 year time frame for a lot of these vehicles. So, for most consumers, buying an EV from purely from an economic standpoint, not from an environmental standpoint, but purely based on the numbers, it doesn't make sense to buy an EV, but for commercial applications like Amazon, you know, and their Prime deliveries, you know, or any other delivery company, or for buses and things like that, the operating costs are a much bigger component of the overall cost of ownership, because, you know, these vehicles are driving 80 to 100,000 miles a year, or in some cases much more, much, you know, as much as 150 to 200,000 miles a year. And you're talking about vehicles that in their internal combustion form might be getting 4, 5, 6 miles per gallon. And so the savings, when you go from a sub 10 mile per gallon vehicle that drives upwards of 100,000 miles a year to an electric version of that, are enormous. And the payback period is now, you know, the difference, you know, is maybe 2 or 3 years versus, you know, 15 to 20 years. So it actually makes a lot of economic sense for companies like Amazon to do this. And, you know, for, you know, so this is big for Amazon, because, you know, they have increasingly been moving their logistics operations in-house. You know, instead of relying on companies like FedEx and UPS and DHL for deliveries, they're increasingly doing it themselves. You know, so you see the Amazon Prime vans in your neighborhood and, you know, in the city streets all the time now, and they're typically using Ram ProMasters and Mercedes Sprinters. And so there's going to be huge savings for Amazon. And then this is also an enormous vote of confidence for Rivian. The fact that Amazon has looked at Rivian and thought, okay, these guys have, they have a, you know, an impressive electric platform that we can build a custom delivery vehicle on. So now you've got a startup that, you know, has, you know, that this deal is like over about 4 years, you know, so you're talking about 25,000 vehicles a year just for one customer. And I think, you know, Rivian was planning to do, you know, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30,000 of their trucks annually to start with, their trucks and SUVs. And then, you know, whatever Ford decides to use. So, you know, they were only going to have a capacity of about, I think, to start of about 50,000 vehicles from their plant in Illinois. So this, you know, pretty much uses up all their capacity. So that, that gives them a lot more scale and, you know, gives, you know, the economics for them, for Rivian, you know, now start to make a lot more sense because you've got, they're going to be selling premium vehicles at a premium price point, you know, under their own brand. They're going to be selling these vehicles to Amazon, potentially to other customers. And so, you know, it's, I think Rivian is actually going to be, you know, a potentially really strong competitor in the EV space, both for personal use vehicles, but also for commercial vehicles. And, you know, I think it will help the adoption of electric vehicles overall.
It will. Absolutely. The other part, too, is that, you know, I ran into my postman and he said, he goes, oh, my gosh, he goes, these Amazon Prime deliveries are driving us crazy because, of course, they as you said, they backed away from some of the major carriers. And so the USPS now is more dependent. However, the your local mailman's truck or mail person's truck is not optimized for packages. It's optimized for letters. Right. And he said that what he's finding is that he has to go back to the post office to reload because they're overloading his truck and he just doesn't have the room. So he goes back and forth and back and forth, which uses more gas, is more inefficient, is more, you know, is more pressure on the environment. So there's a lot of issues with trying to get these packages to people's places, to their delivery places. And so if you've got a custom made van, they're going to be able to deliver much more efficiently. Besides, they're going to be able to deliver, you know, with without emissions, except for the whatever the electricity generates. But then to your point, so Sam, the only thing I wonder is, will this, what kind of effect, I should say, would this have on a consumer looking and saying, you know, will this put Rivian too much on the commercial side? You know, I don't know any consumers that desire to, you know, to drive a Mac car, for instance.
Well, you know, I mean, it's, you know, most people are probably not even going to realize that it's a Rivian platform under there. You know, okay. it may not even have any branding. It's in all likelihood, yeah, it will only have Amazon branding on it. So
fair
you'll
enough,
never,
right.
You know, they'll never, you know, unless they happen to be paying very close attention, they'll probably never even realize that this is from Rivian.
Just
as for, you know, for other commercial vehicles, you know, I don't think people notice, you know, that it's a Ford Transit or a Mercedes Freightliner or a Ram ProMaster.
Well, it's funny because when you see the Mercedes Sprinters that we see around here sometimes, I wonder sometimes, like, what are Mercedes owners think about the fact that they're, you know, so it'll be interesting, but it's such a fantastic deal for Rivian. And as you say, it's really a brand that I don't think a lot of people outside the industry has ever heard of because it's so new.
Right.
And so it's just an incredible way to, you know, to get them off. I mean, it's between this investment and the Ford investment, it's really incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, for, you know, given that, you know, the Amazon Prime vans do a lot of deliveries in residential neighborhoods, you know, having electric vans, you know, that are quieter and cleaner will be, you know, much better for people living in those neighborhoods and also in the
Absolutely.
Cities where they're also doing a lot of deliveries.
Absolutely. No, I think it's as we said at the very beginning of this topic, the commercial space is really ideal for EVs. Now, as an engineering expert, do you think there's going to be battery longevity issues with all those miles put on them? Like, how do you think they'll handle that?
You know, that depends a lot on the battery technology that Rivian's using, which we don't really know much about yet. They haven't revealed many details on that yet. But my guess is that, you know, we've actually been finding, you know, over the first 10 years of the modern EV era, the batteries are mostly lasting pretty, you know, a lot longer than they anticipated, you know, and they used them fairly conservatively to start with. And durability is actually holding up pretty well for most of the EV batteries. I would guess that, for this kind of application, that they're going to be fairly conservative. The Amazon Prime vans don't run, 24 hours a day. They typically, only run, during the day. They're not running at night. They probably don't. One of the things that damages batteries is too much high speed, ultra fast charging. I don't think Amazon's going to need to do that with these. They can charge them at a slower rate, of 20 kilowatts, 20 to 30 kilowatts, maybe 50 kilowatts, rather than 100 or 150 or 350 kilowatts, and still get, the use they need out of them. So I expect they'll probably be fine.
Okay, that's good to know. No, that's cool. I'm excited for them. I think it'll be really fantastic to see this roll out. And one of the other things, too, when I was working on the electric vehicle barrier report for the government, was that we looked at one of the issues that we had with trying to convince like municipalities and even some companies to make these kinds of investments, was that a lot of the times they would say, the executive is saying, here, you need to invest, $10 million in this, but we aren't going to receive we are not going to see the return on this investment, for 7, 8, 10 years. And people would be like, you're not even going to be here anymore, Yeah. And so there was always a sort of discussion of, it was such a long-term return on investment that nobody wanted to make it. And of course, with Amazon, Jeff Bezos really isn't going anywhere. And so he can
He tends to think long-term.
He does.
Over the history of the company, he's invested billions of dollars in infrastructure, for his fulfillment centers, for Amazon Web Services and everything else, which is why their profits have tended to be on the low side through most of the company's history, because he's been making investments, in technologies and infrastructure that the company needs to thrive over the long term.
Right. Absolutely. So he does think long term. And again, I just think it's such a great opportunity for other companies to follow this example as well. So it will definitely be fun to watch.
Yeah. And also to your comment, on the economics of this, for, one Amazon delivery van or one delivery van period going from diesel to electric will probably because of the miles it drives and, where it's starting from a relatively low fuel economy standpoint, each one of those vans will probably have more environmental impact than 20 people buying Teslas.
Absolutely. Or any electric vehicle.
Yeah. Or any EV. Yeah. It really does have a much more significance than, individuals buying EVs. So even if seeing electric Amazon vans doesn't encourage people to go out and buy an EV, just their presence has an impact.
Yes, I agree completely. So now I'm excited about it.
One last EV story before we call it a night. Okay. Canoe.
Yes.
Have you heard of Canoe?
I have heard of Canoe.
That's do you think of say. Canoe? Okay. So let me give the listeners a quick background. So back in late 2017, a couple of former BMW executives, Stefan Krauss and Ulrich Kranz, who were then working at Faraday Future, left Faraday Future as it was going into its extended death spiral. And they took along a whole bunch of Faraday engineers and designers with them. And they started a new car company across town in Irvine called eVelocity. And a few months ago, eVelocity rebranded themselves as Canoe, and that's C-A-N-O-O, not C-A-N-O-E, which is the more typical spelling of canoe.
I do not continue it to canoodling.
And so this past week, they unveiled their first product, which is also called Canoe. So it's Canoe the company and Canoe the vehicle. And so this thing, you know, is a little, I described it as a lozenge on wheels. You know, it's a minivan that's actually surprisingly small. You know, it's only 174 inches long. So it's shorter than your typical compact crossover these days.
If it was pink and white, it would look like Cinderella's carriage, but with wheels instead of the pretty horses. It's not pretty.
No, it's not. but it's interesting. You know, it's built on the skateboard chassis, where everything is by wire, you know, and all the mechanical and electrical systems are contained within the skateboard. So it's a brake by wire, steer by wire, accelerate by wire. You know, the battery pack and the motors and the suspension are all tied together. So this thing is completely self-contained, and then you can just drop different top hats on it. And so the first one they showed is this monobox minivan type of thing that they claim, even though this thing is about the size, you know, it's like 6 inches shorter than an Escape or a Honda CR-V. They claim it's got 188 cubic feet of passenger volume inside because, you know, you don't have to leave space in the front for an engine. And, you know, it basically, you can just expand the passenger volume to fill the entire volume of this vehicle. And it's got this in the back, you know, you got two seats in the front, and then in the back, there's lounge seating around the perimeter of the back of this vehicle. Did you get a chance to take a look at the photos of the thing?
Sadly, yes. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I'm not a fan.
Okay.
You keep talking.
Well, what I think what's actually more interesting, I mean, about
is it going to be self-driving? Is that what they're trying
eventually
to go for?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think eventually, I think, you know, where things get interesting with this one is, you know, the potential for, you know, for autonomous ride hailing services.
That I can see. I mean, the interior actually looks really beautiful. It looks really cool. It's much better on the inside than the outside. The inside the outside is just it looks like a pod, but not in a cool Jetson way. It just looks weird. It just looks like a gelatinous blob. I don't know. I'm not.
I don't disagree with you. It's not a pretty vehicle.
It's not a pretty vehicle.
But it's also a vehicle that you won't be able to buy.
Well, that's good because I don't want to.
It will only be available by subscription. So, you know, you pay a flat monthly fee that is all inclusive, includes the vehicle and service and insurance and everything. And that's it. So one, you know, monthly fee. And whenever you don't want it anymore, you just turn it back in. Or if you want to change to one with a different color or whatever, you can swap it out every month.
Okay, I'm never one to say that things aren't going to work, but hasn't every subscription service gone out of business so far?
No, not all of them. Porsche's is still running. There's a company called Fair, which actually just bought Canvas, which was Ford's subscription division.
They're not thriving, though.
They're not thriving yet, but they're still experimenting with the model. So, you know, and Care by Volvo apparently is doing pretty well. It's popular. I don't know if it's profitable, but it's popular among customers. And some of the other ones are reasonably popular as well. The dealers don't like it, but, you know, the customers seem to like it.
Well, so, it's mobility as a service, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what they're playing into.
Yeah. And this is one of the potential service models that might work. So we'll see. But it's interesting. I think we'll have to keep watching this. You know, Ulrich Kranz is the CTO of Canoe and acting CEO at the moment. Stefan Krauss recently had to step down to deal with some family matters. But Kranz was the he was the head of development on the BMW i3 and i8.
So that's why it looks like what it looks like then, because the i3 looks like a little bubble too. Yeah.
Well, but he wasn't the designer though.
It's hot.
Yeah.
No, there's very qualified people running this, and I shouldn't be so cynical. I think I like it, you know, I like it for the self-driving for that level five. I can see it. It sort of does a lot.
It's going to be a long time before it's level five.
I'm sorry?
It's going to be a long time before it's level five.
It's going to be a very long time before it's level five.
At first, it's only going to be level two.
Yes. Well, but I'm looking at it, you know, if this is what my daily driver is going to be in a level five world, I think it's really attractive from that standpoint. I don't know what it will look like. You know, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of pictures of the cockpit and stuff, like of the driver's seat. There isn't
much there. You know, it's okay. Basically just a bar across it with the steering wheel module and the pedals hanging below it. And it's actually bring your own device for the screen.
I like that.
So, you know, instead of building in a touchscreen, you bring your phone or your tablet and you dock it in there and you run the Canoe app. And so you can customize the interface, you know, with whatever information you want on there, you know, whatever apps you want to use to, you know, for media streaming and things like that.
Right. Volkswagen showed that a number of years ago now in Geneva. And I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. They've shown it on a couple of different concepts over the years. So that's what Canoe is actually planning to do when they launch in 2021.
Okay. All right. Cool. Well, that'll be really interesting. I mean, it's again, the exterior is not at all appealing to me. The interior is beautiful.
Yeah, it's different.
That's a good way to describe it.
Okay. And with that, let's call it a show. And,
that sounds great.
For those of you listening who like the show, like what you heard, you know, please feel free to go into iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever you happen to use to listen to the show and give us a rating and a review. If this is your first time listening, if you're not a regular subscriber, subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you get every episode automatically. It'll just be there for you as soon as it's ready. As soon as we're ready, it'll be ready for you.
Yes. And before I forget, I have to give a shout out to one of our listeners, Blake Swan, who sent me a lovely email. Says how much he enjoys the podcast. He also asked, do you guys take questions for the podcast or have a place to reach out for podcast questions? And yes, we do. So you can always send them on Twitter.
You can send them on Twitter to WheelBearingsCast. You can also go to wheelbearings.media, which is the website. And there's a contact link at the top there. And you can just put in your question in there and it'll show up in our inbox. So feel free to reach out to us either of those ways.
Yes.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Excellent. Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.